Phil, there are so many great television shows and movies.
That's right. Thank goodness Resonance Rewind has the team to analyze them on a personal basis with Rebecca Bond, Robin Pierce, Jenny Bill, Jessica Burtis, Eloise Sheehan, Alex Lefchook, and some key additional guests from the Temporal Nexus.
Aren't you one of those key additional guests?
No, I'm the Temporal Nexus.
Questions to actually find answers to in the next 35 or 40 minutes. Sealed orders. Well, will they ever find Crewman Jackson? Do we actually live in a world of split-second decisions? And what exactly is in missile silo number 4? It's another example of Resonance Rewind going down, down, down in a voyage to the bottom of the sea, a season 4 episode. And already we have interesting views emerging from this particular routine. But let's turn possibly via Robin Pierce to Gary Girardi. Would you like to give us a summation of the episode Précis, please, Robin?
Well, as this season 4 episode begins, we find that the crew of the SSRN Seaview are on a top secret mission. Barely even Admiral Harriman Nelson himself knows what's going on until he opens up his sealed orders. Well, on board is a neutron bomb, which is capable of destroying just about everything on the planet, and they have to deliver this particular bomb to a top secret atoll somewhere in the ocean. We don't even know which ocean, but it's full steam ahead. Sadly, there is a radiation leak expressed as some kind of gaseous leak in an otherwise airtight container. This causes our crew to have some unfortunate hallucinations. The entire crew goes missing. Monsters from Lost in Space and previous Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea episodes pop up. They're almost swallowed by what appears to be seaweed. And, well, I would like to say that hilarity...
I don't think that's like anything like Gary Girardi's written about Robin at all in that particular
no,
aspect.
No, it's not. It's my own take this
yeah,
week.
Yeah, I'll do a summation from the DVD, which
a curse
is basically...
The green filter.
While on a mission to deliver a neutron missile, the men are disturbed by mass hallucinations when the missile malfunctions. Okay, so let's turn to Rebecca. I suspect your first ever episode of Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea. Who knows, maybe your last, but what are your thoughts on this particular excerpt of Owen Allendom?
It is my first, as usual. I'm noticing a theme here. It tends to be my first every single time we do one of these features. However, I'm not so keen on this one, I must say. I'm usually very generous with my reviews, but this time I just could not get attached. I think the concept was interesting. I think the eerie kind of side of it was there almost. I think I just found the ending, without giving too much away, very underwhelming. I think it was too plausible. I wanted to see some aliens or some, you know, some horror or some ghosts or something, and it really was just underwhelming for me. I think it was also very comical at points where it wasn't meant to be. You know, there's the slow-mo, there's the very unconvincing fighting. There's just several points where I just honestly nearly gave up, but I stuck with it. Like I said, I think the storyline was quite interesting, but I just couldn't get into this one. I really couldn't.
Honest viewpoints there. In fact, I can actually quote from Eloise, who is still actually haunted by the submarine noises that are actually coming through on our process, to the extent that her laptop seems to have given up. Eloise's view: I appreciated the colours and lighting effects used within the show, and I like the overall set. It's almost like the TARDIS, I find, the Seaview in many ways. A nuclear submarine that's that big inside, it's amazing. However, the plot sort of hurt my brain, according to Eloise, and vexed me. And obviously, if it vexes Eloise, it could be heading for a strange world indeed. She didn't think any of the characters stood out, and they all blended together for her, and she forgot who was who. All she's been able to hear all day is the ticking background sound of the submarine, and it's driving her around the bend. Oh, wow. Well, I suppose that's a good effect from that point of view. Jenny, has it driven you around the bend?
No, this, when I was young, this was one of my all-time favourite TV shows. I don't think this is a particularly good episode. I don't actually remember having seen it before, but I did actually really, really enjoy it. I am familiar with the characters. I'm familiar with the show. But I did think it was a load of rubbish, and I laughed all the way through it with all the stupid things that, you know, there's a radiation link, so let's just wander down there without any protection on whatsoever. Some of the acting for these are, you know, the two leads are really quite classy actors, but some of the acting in this episode I didn't think was so good. The sets, it looked like it was made on the cheap, you know, the sets and the visual effects, and yeah, and the ending was, it's like it was sort of going and building and building, and suddenly it was over. Before, if you sort of blinked or you lost concentration for a moment, it would have been finished before you'd known. So, yeah.
Written by William Welsh, directed by Harry Harris. And let's actually sort of put an immediate answer to that question. What happened to Crewman Jackson? Well, actually, little in-joke here. The actor who portrayed Jackson was indeed called Jack. He was Jack Basehart. He was actually the son of Richard Basehart. So when Richard Basehart as Admiral Nelson asks, "What's your name, son?" he says, "Jackson, sir." That's going to be worth a couple of points just for that little lovely in-joke from that routine. According to John Abbott, the episode's real problem lies with the mouldering storyline. If William Welsh absolutely had to cobble together another cost-free bottle episode, and one can only presume he was instructed to do so after the expenditure on the likes of Fires of Death and Journey into Fear, we might have asked for two considerations. Firstly, that he not resort to the old empty ship routine yet again, and secondly, that he use a few more clips. Two brief shots of creatures from Night of Terror and The Thing from Inner Space do not make an exciting episode, and the psychedelic sequences, to coin the vernacular of the period, come far too late in the day to make any of this interesting. A major dud for production number 1306. He goes further by actually saying something which you may or may not agree with, Robin. Sealed Orders is yet another late entry to the series with a plot that makes no sense at all. Apart from rehashing the tired All Alone on the subroutine from the human computer in the Death Watch to other monumental bores, the story is riddled with minor and major idiocies. Minor examples would include how easy it was for ordinary Seaman Kowalski and Chief Sharkey to play around with the hangar for a neutron bomb, the fact that the circuitry room, from which weekly devastation and calamity is frequently wrought, never seems to be manned, except occasionally by one person looking in the wrong direction, and why Kowalski's search party for the missing circuitry room crew are all brandishing guns.
Well, that's a very good point, and it was one that I was going to bring up, actually, because... they're looking for the specialist technician who can tell them what's happening with this neutron bomb.
Where is he? His suitcase is there.
Nowhere to be seen. So Kowalski and two crewmen go looking for him. Now, okay, armed. Okay, that's a bit of a stretch. But they actually had their guns drawn. Now, that struck me as odd. Now, please understand, I'm not bigging myself up here. I am certainly no expert in submarines, but isn't it a really really bad idea to fire guns on a submerged submarine.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing is, it's all a hallucination that it's the empty ship. So we can, this is, it's inferred that the rest of the crew are still there. So they're looking at the command crew go around the, doing all these antics, fighting each other. I suspect the rest of the crew can't see the green filter or the slow-mo, but I can imagine that the bridge, the control room, is fully manned when Admiral Nelson goes down the adjoining hatch to the flying sub and starts shooting that up with a gun. And nobody thinks, you know, sort of, stop him. The guy's gone crazy. I mean, were they all thinking they're saying, oh, somebody's having a bad day? You know, it's just really odd. Now, everything sparks up. Even the missile chambers sparks up and there are sparks, flames everywhere. Why does a leak of gas in the missile room cause the Seaview rock and roll where everything blows up and the ship's going from side to side crazily? Everything about this is cheap and tawdry. And from a high-end 60s TV series, I would have expected a great deal more. You know, I've always disliked these episodes where, I mean, we had a third season episode of Star Trek where Kirk was the only person wandering around the empty soundstage of the Enterprise.
It made sense in the Mark of Gideon, Robin. It made sense.
It made sense of that one. It was a cheap episode, but it made sense. This one, it's just nasty. And at the end, when the rocket does get launched, everybody says, it's the end of the world. Cut. Whew, that was a close one. And I'm thinking, what?
We live in a world of second discussions.
It was nonsense, and we all know it.
There are a lot of questions I know about the neutron bomb, but I don't know the answers. And also my classic line with respect to Richard Basehart and Admiral Harriman Nelson, this inspection hatch is sealed. It obviously means it's not to be tampered with. So then he proceeds to go and tamper with it, which is good. So I think, you know, I actually, initially when I saw this, I could appreciate Isaac Asimov saying, this is what he calls science fiction that's been made to insult the audience. Not even at its nadir, could you ever actually seen that with respect to Star Trek. However, I will actually qualify it by saying that Rebecca sort of questioned about aliens. We could have actually gone for the episode that follows this, which is even more interesting in terms of the aliens that take the crew to the planet Venus, which is, you know, extraordinary. But that's for another time, another case. David Hedison, of course, has also...
I actually, just cutting across for a second, Alex, on the DVD, the next episode along showed... You know, had just a picture of the alien on the menu, and it looked like one of those smash reconstituted potato aliens from the 1970s had a baby with a frog.
Yes, he's from the planet Centaur. And in fact,
more interesting than this one. Yes. So I'm willing to give that.
I agree.
you know, he's from the planet Centaur because he's called Centaur, and his partner is also called Centaur because they're from the planet Centaur, and they can also travel.
Should we start referring to each other as Earth now, then?
Centaur.
Yes, Earth.
Yes. And in terms of that, we certainly find that initially I was thinking, what can we say that actually has promise for this? Because Rebecca obviously was looking to sort of address those positive things. It is a ship in a bottle episode. It does actually entitle one to sort of see the notion of dealing with sealed orders, the kind of notion of explosions. It's set in the year 1981. So thank heavens we've actually managed to get through that whole process successfully. Obviously the far future for the 1960s. And I felt that David Hedison probably had a point when he said that actually for him, after the first season, Lost in Space began to lose its way, and certainly by the time we got to the fourth season, it certainly seemed to have lost its plot. It was very much a popular series of its time, but in this particular instance, again, when you have the whole notion of the kind of lines that we have, which is it's number three on C deck, is that as dangerous as it sounds? Why should number three on A deck be as dangerous as it actually sounds? Certainly the script, I don't think it's one of William Welsh's finest in any way, shape or form. Although, you know, having said that, the notion of the way to cook at all is nicely put together. I think Richard Basehart tries up to a point, and the slow motion running is extraordinary. because obviously that presages and foreshadows the $6 million man, amongst others, in terms of slow motion, etc. I'm getting a sense here, Jenny, that, you know, it's difficult to really come up with something. Although, having said that, you know, I was around the 4 out of 10 mark for a lot of this, but then I'm going to award this a 6, actually, because repeated viewings, it begins to sink in all sorts of ways. But Jenny, any other sort of thoughts that you could say, or are you also affected by the bing, bing, bing sound of the sea view?
Because I'm quite familiar with the series, I sort of put to one side all the silly things about it. And I actually quite enjoyed the sort of suspense of not really understanding why the crew were disappearing until it got to about maybe 2/3, 3/4 of the way through, when it started to seem a little bit.
Where is that specialist from the Pentagon?
We never ever saw him. And what it made me think of, that thing Chinese whispers, where you write something on a piece of paper and you pass it on to the next person and they write something else. Well, I kind of felt that's how the script was done, because it was like they didn't seem to have any idea at the end or at the beginning what was going to happen at the end. And at the end, they didn't seem to have any idea what had gone on in the rest of it. And it was all just like odd things put together. I mean, so I can't give it a particular...
Could we interpret it as basically being just like a bad dream? That actually, in terms of the actual narrative, that what you've got here is that classic, almost Freudian aspect here. That, and this maybe addresses Robin's point of view, that if we kind of take it from the perspective of actually nothing is real, and it's just literally one bad fix, that even Admiral Nelson refers to as one bad fix, that they've actually just been taking some magic mushrooms onto Seaview, and in terms of obviously waiting for that ultimate explosion, phew, it's all right, because we live in a world of split-second decisions.
Can we take it that your repeated viewing of this episode is the beginning of some kind of weird Stockholm syndrome that you're suffering, and you're giving it, like, 6? And, you know, I honestly tried to like this, because, as you know, Alex, I'm a big Irwin Allen fan. That's what got me started. But this episode, 6. Ooh. I mean, the only things that I think that I liked about it were, I've watched several of the black and white episodes recently. And seeing them in colour, wow, that's really vivid colour. The cinematography is good. The use of colour is good. Albeit the green filters were weird. But this one, it just pushed too far. And it's strange, because I'd been looking forward to it, because I've sat through all of The Prisoner, and I thought, okay, Wonder Woman, that was better than I remembered. I thought Voice of the Bottom of the Sea, this is going to be a safe bet for me. And I was watching it. I watched it on Monday, and it was just like, oh, I do have a vague memory of seeing it before, but I don't think I could do repeated viewings. Why do you do it to yourself?
It's a way of getting oneself into the zone. It appreciates the whole sort of aspect of that. And yeah, as I say, those are the sort of things. But even with repeating viewings, it's difficult to really kind of find a huge amount to actually give the series credit. Because, again, it's difficult. And again, I go back to that notion of the science is preposterous. You cannot actually have a neutron bomb in a sealed container which is leaking gas, which is hallucinogenic. By no stretch of the imagination of science that we actually work in our planet Earth today, is that remotely feasible. But then actually that is a kind of classic Irwin Allen aspect that suddenly doesn't really take.
That's where you draw the line, not the submarine being threatened by giant seaweed?
Again, there are other issues with respect to that. And I think it's interesting insofar as clearly this was peak time viewing. It was the fourth season. Yeah. It was the final season in terms of as it transpired. But it didn't quite work on that basis. Having said that, again, I think there are certain aspects to be said. If you actually read it from the perspective of it being literally a hallucination, the whole thing is a hallucination, a bad dream from the off. If you take it on that basis, you can see it as possibly actually developing a sort of interesting narrative. But in terms of actually following the plot in the same way as you mentioned The Prisoner, though, I mean, Rebecca, I think, has been converted to The Prisoner. I certainly was, in terms of the allegory, in terms of the range of material that was put together within that field. That was certainly saying a whole range of issues. In this particular instance, I don't think there's really much to be said in terms of the authorial intention, or at least it doesn't appear to be, other than, as I say, the notion that, well, we live in a world of split-second decisions, and unless we actually have that fail-safe scenario, which, again, curiously, I couldn't quite work out why the computer seemed to be counting upwards as opposed to be counting downwards.
Another thing with the radiation, leak.
It could have been affected by the radiation. The flip side, of course, is that we also have a scenario where, in terms of the start of the series, and this is a plus factor for me, at least in the opening credits, Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, the ship is actually going down, because for the first season, it's actually going up in terms of those opening credits. And that always worried me. You know, that always irritated me insofar as you'd have Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea and the sea view would be actually be rising at the start of the credits as opposed to actually going down. Rebecca, we're back to yourself again. How did you feel about some of the comedy effects? I mean, Chief Sharky, let's face it, if you can't find anybody, you know, let's say you turn up on campus sometime, you know, post-lockdown, whenever that may be, and we're still actually, we're doing blended learning and so on. You talk, nobody's actually around. Is your first action going to be, I know you're here, I know you're here, and then proceeds to wreck all of the sort of areas and make it look as though there's been a fight in that particular area? Is that something which you kind of think, does that kind of fit with kind of, well, this is a healthy way to actually behave?
I don't think so. And I think the whole episode, it really bothered me how at no point did they say, something strange is going on. It was always, we'll find him. Oh, he's not here. Maybe he's looking for so-and-so. And there was this constant to-ing and fro-ing of like, oh, it's all fine. It'll sort itself out. No, you've got a bomb leaking on your submarine. You know, you've got guns, as Robin pointed out. Not the best idea. The next minute, they're all attacking each other. It was so confusing in the way they were trying to resolve this issue. There were so many better options they could have taken, and I think that's what made it so comical, in my opinion. I think it wasn't meant to be, but I enjoyed it for that reason. There were so many visual effects as well that just they amused me. They really did. And like I said, there was an attempt there. I mean, again, I think it's very unfair to judge the series as a whole based off this one episode. I think because I've heard great things about it, if I watched the rest I'd be quite impressed. But based on this one, I'm not convinced. Can't relate to any of the characters or their story at all. But I might watch the rest and see if I can change my opinion.
We will be looking at another episode from the first season later on in Resonance Rewind. I wouldn't necessarily say go through the 110 odd episodes of four seasons.
I don't think I have time for that anyway.
Exactly. There are other things to do. Nice to see that the coffee was hot, though, in the crew room. And, of course, that the jazz music was nicely sort of bouncy. Yeah. Obviously, you have a record player as well.
We had seen the sea view tossed all over the sea.
Even after
the record player was okay.
Yeah. On the table. The coffee didn't even get spilt after all the rock and rolling.
And something else that I want to point out, I mean, the Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea was originally a feature film before it became a TV series. And it was a major plot point in that film that all crew members were wearing the radiation badges that turned colour if they were... What happened to those? I mean, really?
I can see, Robin, that you're not impressed with respect to this entry into the oeuvre. Jenny, does this make you reevaluate your score for Teen Titans Go back in the day?
No.
Extraordinary.
You're never going to let me get over that, are you?
And Robin, likewise, does it kind of make you rethink about, well, maybe Assignment Earth is actually a classic in the making, because at least they don't do the same thing as they've done with respect to Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea? Has this disillusioned you or disabused you of some of the Irwin Allen wonderments that you've been spreading over the last few months?
Well, I happen to watch Robert Lansing, who was Gary Seven, of course, from Assignment Earth, in the pilot film of Automan last night. And I still haven't forgiven him for Assignment Earth, I'm afraid.
No. He was in The Equalizer as well, of course, but that's another line entirely. Rebecca, what about music? Paul Sortel, of course, writes the theme, or wrote the theme to Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea. Did you feel that actually sort of carried with it a suitable level of accompaniment for the episode?
I actually always enjoy the music that accompanies these, the ones you've looked at in these features. I find they actually really add something. And that was something I quite enjoyed about it. I mean, even when the record was playing, I know that was part of the plot, but even just the music choice really did add something. It made it almost, eerie because it was that uplifting music and it's playing by itself, you know, that has that horror aspect to it. So I think music was used really cleverly. And even during the slow-mo bits when there was music, yes, it was a bit cheesy, but it was so entertaining. I think it was used well. So I'm always impressed by the music use. And I don't think that was any different in this one. I was quite pleasantly surprised. So,
and indeed, they slowed down the theme to Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea for that. And let's go back to characters, because clearly we have pretty much the main cast being put together here in terms of David Hedison as Captain Lee Crane, Richard Basehart as Admiral Nelson, Kowalski, Del Monroe played Kowalski, and of course we have Chief Sharkey and Chip Morton, of course, played by the late Bob Dowdell. Any of those float your boat? I mean, it's always wonderful, isn't it? I would have thought, Robin, that we can have an entirely white male cast with not a single sort of indication, apart from maybe the sea view, if you actually refer to the ship as she, which is there, with any sort of notion that it's not just a single gender universe within Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea. Rebecca, well, any thoughts about your favourites of that cast list?
I agree with Eloise there. I don't think there are actually any, you know, characters that really stand out. I came away from it thinking they all blended into one. I think they all had a similar characteristic as well. They didn't have anything very distinctive about themselves. I think the only one I actually remember was, I believe it was the Admiral, because I remember thinking he was very suspicious and I thought he'd have something to do with the disappearances. Maybe he was an alien or something like that. So I think that's the only thing I took away from the characters. And I'm not saying the acting was bad. The acting was there. It was, you know, fine. But character-wise, I just don't think they were developed well enough for me to really have a memorable, you know.
And certainly Richard Basehart, well-known Shakespearean actor, in his character of Admiral Nelson, was regularly possessed by aliens throughout the series. In fact, two episodes down the line, he's possessed by an orchid, which is obviously very problematic, which is going to take over the planet. Indeed, they grow a number of orchids literally around the nuclear power plant, in another sort of classic case of how the series can really abuse our version of science. Exactly. I mean, again, wow. see it as a great trip. A trip which basically you might have actually been engaging, if not that I would ever recommend this at all, but if you take LSD, if you were dropping acid, this would be the kind of experience I suspect you might come up with. Maybe that's William Welsh's secret. Jenny, are you sticking with the Admiral as your main character, or is it Lee Crane? Is it David Hedison? Or are you going to go for Del Monroe, or indeed Bob Dowdell?
Oh, dear.
Or is it Jackson, the unnamed Jack, yes. Who's actually there, who seems to be just on his knee for most of the time, and then goes off to actually help a search party and gets promptly vanished.
I actually don't think they had a very good script to work with that allowed any of them to really develop their characters, comparing it with other episodes. I suppose I like both the lead characters. I think they are, during the series, they are particularly strong characters. The others are all a little bit kind of throwaway, happy-go-lucky young chappies. I think
wearing gym shoes, of course. It's always important to wear gym shoes.
I do love the set. I think the set is fabulous. That's one of the things I always really liked. I'm a bit into marine stuff, so I always loved the set. I know it changed slightly over the series.
It became bigger and then was used in Batman 66, the movie. So it's all parcel of the joyous sea view, which is marvellous. And again, I actually sort of had lights which counted upwards as opposed to counting downwards again. Robin, what about yourself? Is it a case of you can't find one character who redeems this episode? Do you think, actually, when push comes to shove, you know, Chip Morton, he's obviously on the case, even with his glycerin, which is nicely put together. I love the way in which they regularly will have glycerin aboard the main characters, because they're obviously finding it very, very stressful.
Yeah. Well, to me, Richard Basehart as Admiral Nelson always sounds a bit bored and fatigued of the script. It's like, well, here I am again. And he delivers everything flat. That's in contrast to David Hedison, who delivers every single line between gritted teeth and tersely, because every line may be his last. My character of the episode was the great unspoken one. Let's give it up to the finest submarine, and I'm including the Nautilus and SeaQuest in this. Seaview is the most beautiful submarine ever seen on screen. I love that ship. ¶¶
I would obviously say Stingray, but that's for another episode for another time and another sort of experience. But that's by the by. And curiously enough, I think I'll go on record here saying that you probably have more decent science and more decent characterization of a 25-minute episode of Stingray than you have in pretty much an entire season of Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea. But that's another line entirely. Life continues. I shall reveal that Eloise Sheehan has actually gone for 5 out of 10 for her score for Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, Sealed Orders. We don't know what our North Carolina correspondent, Jessica Burtis, will have actually gone, because she seems to have vanished from the whole sort of system. Maybe she's just maybe lost the link. Who knows what could have actually happened on that basis. Rebecca, what is your particular score line for this particular number?
I think mine's going to have to be a 5 out of 10 as well. As I said, I think it's unfair to judge the series as a whole, which we're not anyway. I'd like to watch some more as we're going to see how I react to the other ones. But this one didn't quite, you know, the plot wasn't there and I didn't quite get as involved. So 5 for effort.
However, through the mysterious world of email and sealed orders, and I'm opening up her little sealed orders now. Proving that we live in a world of split-second decisions, Jessica is actually connecting with us and communicating with us. I think she's going to press the button. So she would give the Orb episode, well, I won't fire on that. It's not a genre that she would usually watch, but it was a fun underwater adventure, says Jessica. She thinks the set was the strong point, as the lighting was very evocative and really well done. It gave her flashbacks to when she had a school trip in elementary school to sleep on the World War II airship carrier USS Yorktown. They do things so much more differently in the United States, don't they? You know, when's the last time you actually had an elementary school trip to sleep on an aircraft carrier, Rebecca? I mean, you know, it's just a whole new world, isn't it?
Can't say I ever have. Can't say I've ever done that.
Likewise, I feel cheated now that never once was I actually taken to actually sleep on the Ark Royal. You know, what's
going on? I've actually slept in an aquarium before, in front of a massive tank full of turtles and stingrays and all sorts, as part of Girl Guides. So that was an interesting one.
Well, that at least sort of raises the bar somewhat from that point of view. But, you know, sleeping on a World War II airship carrier. Anyway, she continues. That was obviously named after the last major battle of the Revolutionary War. Yes, we know that, Jessica. There's no need to actually sort of make this point, even though you're not here. Let's face it. It's now serving as a pretty cool naval museum. So she's added a point for nostalgia. And her score for this particular sequence from Jessica Burtis, he's 7 out of 10. One more than myself. I'm going to go for 6 out of 10. Rebecca, you're on a 5 out of 10. Eloise is on a 5 out of 10. We know Robin might be plumbing the depths even further on that sort of system. But Jenny, what's your particular score?
Yeah, I have to give it a 7 as well. I know it was a really crappy episode, but I still really, really enjoyed it.
So curiously, I think the first time in quite some time, both Rebecca and myself are kind of in the mid-range here with a 6 and a 5. I actually have to say, all honesty, first time round, Rebecca, would have struggled to get above 4 for me. This was where it was. It was 3 to 4.
Wow.
It's only through repeated viewings and seeing it through a different lens, different colour lens, that I've actually...
Yeah, still not seeing how you're doing these repeated viewings, though. I don't think I'd watch that again. Not that particular one.
I wouldn't advise it, but it is just one way forward in terms of, you know, maybe... Because, you know, when I saw the rerun back in the Channel 4 days of the 1980s, and then, of course, a couple of times on DVD, etc. So, Robin, we turn to your good self after that damning overview of Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea. Where are you going to position your routine? I can see you shaking your head at obviously Jenny and Jessica thumping sevens there. So from that point of view, William Welsh results, really.
Dive, dive, dive. It's a voyage to the bottom of the points. I can't find it in my heart to give this any more than a 3. And that's me really wanting to like it. They did so many episodes that were so, so much better. And yet we were stuck with this.
No, I looked around another 3 episodes. And of that quartet in the final season, this was the one that I felt, well, at least this one doesn't have a Dutch trader who has been sort of foolishly sort of lost from the Flying Dutchman, etc., who again possesses part of the ship, or indeed those aforementioned Taurians and indeed centaurs.
What about Vincent Price and the Deadly Dolls? That would have been fun.
Well, that might well emerge in the not-too-distant future, but you'll be pleased to know, Rebecca, that we're going down the line of the Green Hornet and Batman, that's Batman and the Green Hornet, for the next edition of Resonance Rewind, in which we have not one, but two episodes of the 1966 edition of Batman, that's with Adam West, which you can delight in. And it's just as well, actually, we've gone for two, because I thought we could go for one, but they're just 25 minutes in length, and we'd finish on a cliffhanger, or at least we'd end on a cliffhanger. And we thought, let's go for two.
That's true.
We've got Colonel Gum in there. Colonel Gum, played by Roger C. Carmel. Again, a fun show, an interesting show. It's where it's going to take us in the next Resonance Rewind. That has been Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea. Actually doing a lot better than I thought it was going to do originally, and that's why I kind of was thinking, well, this is probably going to be a four or a three all round. But Jessica, obviously convinced by her USS Yorktown experience, has kind of bumped up the average, and Jenny, for nostalgia alone, has pushed the thing up from that body. Just goes to show, make your own mind up, check it out, Resonance Rewind, those are pointers in the direction of positivity. I just wonder, Robin, not so much the specialist from the Pentagon, but what do you think the specialist editor of Starburst magazine, how would he have actually reviewed it? Would it have been boring, 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 or whatever?
Well, here's a bit of trivia for you. My first ever article for Starburst was actually an overview of Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea. And I did the opposite of John Brosnan, who loathed it and wrote it up.
And yet this episode clearly didn't manage to echo with your good self in terms of the way forward. So it goes. Keep on resonating.